Every investor wants exactly the same thing. I mean, we all want a colossal return on an infinite amount of capital sustained forever. But what if the very architecture of business makes having all three of those physically impossible?
Yeah, that is the ultimate paradox of capital, really. You're basically asking a corporate structure to do something it simply was not built to do. Gaining an advantage on one of those fronts inevitably means, paying a severe price for it somewhere else. The physics of business demand a trade-off.
Right. And we are jumping straight into the deep end today. We're pulling from a really fascinating stack of research industry articles, some historical case studies, and we're drawing heavily from The Infinite Investor, which is a chapter in the broader Averaging Up collection.
It's a fantastic collection.
It really is. And our mission for this deep dive is to sort of sift through all of this to understand why compounding is actually an arbitrage of structural tensions. And by arbitrage, in this context, we mean the deliberate trading of one finite resource, like a really high rate of return in exchange for another, like durability over time.
Exactly. It is not, it's not a simple volume dial. A company can just turn up whenever they want.
Yeah, we're going to decode exactly how the world's most durable companies navigate this harsh reality.
And to truly grasp that, I think we must recognize that these tensions are not accidental. They are, they're woven into the very fabric of commerce. So to buy a business is to buy its specific structural arbitrage, exactly as it stands. You're inheriting its compromises.
Okay, let's ground this with a visual for you listening.
Right.
Think of like the character creation screen in a role-playing video game. You're given a finite number of stat points,
Oh, I love this analogy.
right? If you want to max out your character's speed, you have to sacrifice defense. If you want maximum strength, well, you lose agility. A business operates under this exact same law of physics. It literally cannot max out every compounding trade at once.
That framing gets right to the core of it, I mean, perfectly. But before we look at where businesses are forced to compromise those metaphorical stat points, we first need to establish what they're actually trying to achieve in the first place.
Right.
Every business, if you strip it down to its studs, is simply a flow of capital between two distinct reservoirs.
The toll and the wave.
Yes. The first reservoir is the toll. This is the cash the business extracts from its operations in the present. It has a short duration. It's harvested right now.
So, like a major tech company selling a smartphone today.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The profit from that single transaction, that is the toll.
Got it.
Then the second reservoir is the wave. This is the growth that builds over time. It has a much longer duration, and the economic value is realized much later. So the entire lifeblood of an enterprise is determined by how efficiently it takes the capital from the toll and reinvests it into the wave.
Okay, so what the toll absorbs, it reinvests. And that reinvestment is governed by three very specific structural measures, which we touched on at the very beginning: return, quantity, and duration.
Right. And to define those clearly, return is the actual percentage rate earned on the reinvested capital.
The yield, basically.
Yeah. Quantity is the sheer volume, the absolute dollar amount of capital the business can actually deploy at that specific rate. And duration is the length of time it can sustain that entire internal engine without breaking down.
Which naturally brings us to what the infinite investor outlines as the perfect model.
Yeah.
This is the absolute dream scenario, right? A business that earns a sky-high return on a staggering quantity of capital sustained for a full century.
The Holy Grail.
Literally, it never hands capital back to the owners in the form of dividends or buybacks because
Yeah.
it always has a highly productive place to put that money internally.
But here is where we must be ruthlessly analytical, right? The perfect model is purely a theoretical reference point.
Right?
It does not exist in the wild. Holding all three of those components, return, quantity, and duration at their absolute peak simultaneously is something virtually no business manages to achieve.
I have to push back on that framework just a bit, though. I mean, if the perfect model doesn't exist in reality, why do we even use it as the foundational measuring stick? Aren't we just setting up an impossible, frustrating standard for the businesses we look at?
Well, we use it the exact same way physicists use the concept of a frictionless vacuum.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, a frictionless environment doesn't exist in the real world, but you absolutely must establish the ideal state so you can accurately measure the real-world drag.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
Right. The perfect compounder is our frictionless vacuum. The closer a real business comes to holding those three components together without breaking apart, the closer it is to the ideal. We require that impossible standard to evaluate the compromises companies are actually forced to make.
Because the friction is where reality happens. So let's look at the structural tensions, the friction points. Why can't we have it all? Why do these three components inherently pull against each other?
Well, high return versus large quantity is the first major structural tension. If you analyze the businesses generating the absolute highest returns on invested capital, they're almost always capital-light models.
Like software as a service companies.
Exactly. Software, consulting firms, licensing models, they require very little physical capital to operate or to scale their revenues.
Right, because they don't have to build a billion-dollar manufacturing facility just to sell a second copy of their code. The marginal cost of replication is essentially zero.
Precisely. Their earnings are immense relative to the capital they employ. But, and this is key, that very lightness becomes their critical limitation.
Because they can't absorb it.
Right. Because they need so little capital to operate, they possess virtually no heavy base to absorb the vast cash flow they're generating. They simply cannot reinvest large quantities of capital internally at those same 40 or 50% rates.
It's like a high-performance sports car with a tiny trunk. I mean, it moves incredibly fast. That's your high return. But it simply cannot carry much cargo, which is your quantity of capital.
That is a brilliant way to put it. And what happens when you try to hitch a massive cargo trailer to that sports car?
The chassis snaps.
The chassis snaps. That is exactly what happens to a software company's return profile when it tries to deploy billions of dollars internally. Because the core business doesn't need the cash, management often ends up making, overpriced acquisitions.
Or funding speculative side projects.
Exactly. And the return on invested capital just plummets. The structural lightness that created the high return outright prevents the absorption of large quantities of capital.
So if you're looking at your own portfolio right now, you probably have an asset-light SaaS company boasting a massive return on invested capital. But look closer, right?
Yeah.
Where is that cash actually going to go next year? They can't funnel it back into the same high return engine. That's the trap.
Which forces us to look at the second structural tension, high return versus long duration. Let's assume you do find a business earning an exceptional rate of return, and it manages to deploy a decent amount of capital. That high return acts as a glaring signal to the broader economy that excess profits are available for the taking.
High returns are blood in the water, and capitalism is the shark.
Oh, exactly. The attack is relentless. Fierce competition is a mathematical certainty.
Mm.
To sustain a high return for decades requires an impenetrable barrier, but, all barriers are ultimately finite.
Right.
The higher the return you are generating, the stronger the economic incentive for competitors to attack it. And the harder it becomes to defend that profit pool over a long duration. Rivals will happily accept a slightly lower return just to steal your market share, which continually drives the industry average down.
Okay, but what if a company just accepts that it cannot fight the competition forever?
Right.
Like, what if it gives up the dream of sky-high returns in exchange for pure survival and scale? How does the math change then?
Well, that leads directly to the third pairing, quantity versus duration. These two are actually highly compatible. Yeah. A business can absolutely reinvest staggering quantities of capital for a very long time, but buying that compatibility almost always costs the business its high rate of return.
Got it.
The types of physical assets that can absorb enormous amounts of capital and hold their ground against competition for decades, like sprawling infrastructure, they are rarely the assets that generate spectacular software-like returns. You purchase scale and time, but you sacrifice the rate.
So if every business must compromise in some way, what does the most successful real-world compromise actually look like?
It looks like what the averaging up collection defines as the heavy toll.
The heavy toll.
Yeah. If the perfect model is the impossible ideal, the heavy toll is the closest humanity has come to replicating it in the physical world. These are businesses that outright refuse to hand capital back to their owners. Instead, they continually absorb it into a vast, expanding asset base.
So we're talking about like transcontinental railways, heavily regulated utilities, colossal large-scale infrastructure projects.
Exactly. They employ enormous quantities of capital, and crucially, they can keep employing more as the physical world they serve continues to expand. They hold quantity and duration at their absolute fullest, and they accept a return that is respectable and steady, but, not astronomical.
And here's where it gets incredibly counterintuitive for me and likely for you listening as well. We are so conditioned by modern financial media to think of heavy physical assets as a critical weakness.
Oh, absolutely.
We praise asset-light businesses constantly.
Yeah.
We treat weight as a structural drag on the income statement. But in the framework of the heavy toll, the weight isn't a weakness at all. It's actually a shield.
That is the pivotal insight. Capital intensity is the moat. What costs a great deal to build costs a great deal to replicate.
Right.
The sheer billions in capital required to lay down a second competing transcontinental rail network across mountainous terrain is exactly what keeps competitors from even trying.
Because who wants to spend that money?
Exactly. The lightness that produces high returns in software invites competition because the cost of entry is negligible. But the heavy tolls weight protects its position across decades.
The cost to build equals the cost to compete. And the ultimate masterclass in this, I mean, the absolute industrialization of the toll is Berkshire Hathaway.
It really is the clearest historical instance of bringing both halves of this equation together under one corporate roof. They've essentially married a limitless zero-cost supply of capital with heavy bases that are explicitly designed to absorb it endlessly.
The insurance float. Let's break down the mechanics of this because it is just brilliant.
It is. So Berkshire's insurance operations collect premiums up front and pay claims much later. The cash they hold in the interim is called float.
Right.
It is a staggering source of capital that essentially costs them nothing, and sometimes they're even paid to hold it, depending on underwriting profitability. It's effectively a liability on the balance sheet that acts exactly like free equity. But rather than just letting tens of billions of dollars sit idle or deploying it into fragile, high-return ventures, they funnel it directly into regulated, heavy infrastructure they own outright.
Like BNSF, their sprawling freight railway, and Berkshire Hathaway Energy.
Exactly. Because those bases operate within a regulated framework, the return is earned on the physical asset base itself. Every single dollar of float absorbed into laying new track or building new transmission lines actually enlarges the base on which their future authorized return is calculated.
That's incredible.
They don't need to pay the capital back to shareholders because they've constructed an internal machine specifically calibrated to ingest it.
Okay, I understand how this works for a 19th century technology like a railway or a 20th century power grid. But how does a modern digital company, a tech giant, possibly replicate this heavy physical logic today?
Look at Alphabet. Alphabet is taking exactly this historical logic and applying it to a brand new substrate.
Wait, you mean by taking search cash flow and redirecting it into cloud and AI infrastructure?
Yes. Alphabet generates astonishing amounts of cash from its core search business. That is their toll. It is so vast that their existing digital operations cannot possibly absorb it all. If they remained purely asset light, that chassis would snap.
Right.
So they faced a stark choice. Return the surplus cash to owners as an admission that internal compounding is over, or build a new base capable of absorbing it.
They chose to build. And not just build, but build heavy.
Extremely heavy. They are constructing immense cloud and artificial intelligence data centers. It's a wildly capital-intensive base. We're talking about laying down intercontinental fiber optic cables and assembling clusters of GPUs that cost billions.
It's massive.
The technology is cutting edge, sure, but the structural logic is identical to a railroad. They are building a place to absorb their immense cash flow so they can keep compounding internally rather than overflowing. And the sheer capital required to build competing AI infrastructure cements their moat, just like laying steel tracks did in the 1800s.
What's really fascinating here is a detail from the deep dive sources. Berkshire Hathaway actually took a position in Alphabet.
Which is an incredibly potent signal if you think about it.
Yeah.
Berkshire's entire discipline is built on refusing to deploy capital if the absorption won't be productive. The fact that the world's most demanding allocator looked at Alphabet's colossal spending on AI infrastructure and decided it was a productive absorption of capital, not just setting money on fire, is a powerful validation of the strategy. Alphabet is building a modern heavy toll.
But there is a hidden danger lurking here, isn't there? Mm-hmm. We've established how great a heavy base is for absorbing capital. But a heavy base is only a moat if there is a wave.
Exactly. The wave is the absolute non-negotiable condition for the heavy toll to function.
Right.
The wave is the secular expansion of the activity the business serves. By secular expansion, we mean a relentless, long-term macroeconomic trend that provides an ever-growing pool of demand. As long as that wave is running, as long as there is underlying systemic growth to reinvest into the heavy base, absorbs capital productively.
But what happens when the wave stops, like when the market is fully saturated?
Then the very weight that served as your greatest asset suddenly mutates into a tremendous burden.
Ouch.
Yeah. Without a wave of secular growth, capital intensity stops compounding cash and starts immobilizing it. The heavy assets still demand massive maintenance capital just to avoid falling apart, But they are no longer expanding your returns. It becomes trapped capital. You're feeding the beast just to keep it alive, not to help it grow.
So a heavy capital-intensive base is a powerful moat as long as the tide is coming in. But the second the tide goes out, that exact same moat turns into an anchor.
Beautifully said. And we possess a brilliant historical example of a company realizing this exact dynamic, the Coca-Cola Company.
Right. Coca-Cola is a perfect case study because they structurally separated the light from the heavy.
Historically, Coca-Cola owned sprawling, capital-intensive bottling operations alongside their highly profitable capital-light syrup concentrate business.
Ah.
For decades, the underlying wave of global volume growth was surging. Entering emerging markets and global population growth provided this relentless wave of new, thirsty consumers. So the heavy physical bottling base absorbed capital beautifully to meet that demand.
Makes sense.
But eventually, in mature markets, that wave of pure volume growth began to flatten.
The secular expansion basically dried up. The tide stopped coming in.
Exactly. And Coca-Cola analyzed the math of their structural arbitrage. Between 2013 and 2018, they radically reversed course and refranchised their bottling operations.
Wow.
They handed the heavy, capital-intensive physical plants and truck fleets over to independent bottlers, and they kept the high-return, asset-light concentrate business entirely for themselves.
So it was a conscious strategic decision to amputate the heavy base.
Yes, because without the wave, both light and heavy businesses suffer. They both end up overflowing cash back to owners instead of compounding internally. But the heavy business suffers vastly more.
Because the asset-light business can just hand the cash back cleanly, right?
Exactly. The light business simply pays a dividend. It has no physical assets demanding upkeep. But the heavy business, the physical bottler, is forced to keep committing vast amounts of capital just to maintain stagnant factories and aging truck fleets.
Right.
Coca-Cola recognized that without the wave of volume growth, the weight of the bottling operations was no longer a shield against competitors. It was just an anchor dragging down their returns.
This genuinely forces a shift in how you evaluate a company. Given the inherent risks of receding waves and the economic certainty that high returns will eventually erode due to fierce competition, how do we evaluate which of the three components, return, quantity, or duration, actually matters the most?
Well, duration is the practical tiebreaker.
Really? Why is that?
The reason comes down to the raw exponential mathematics of how compounding accumulates. Return and quantity dictate how much economic value is added in a single period, but duration determines how many periods compound upon one another.
Because compounding is an exponential curve, not a linear progression.
Exactly. Because each period builds on the accumulated snowballing result of every period that came before it, time heavily outweighs the rate over the long run.
That makes total sense.
A moderate return that is sustained for a very long time will mathematically outrun a spectacular high return that is only sustained briefly before competition destroys it. The underlying structure of compounding disproportionately rewards time over speed.
Which brings us to the ultimate analytical razor in the averaging up framework, the 100-year question.
Right. When you are faced with evaluating complex businesses across variables that fundamentally cannot be optimized simultaneously, the 100-year question cuts through the noise. It asks simply, will this business still be here and still be compounding reasonably a full century from now?
I want to clarify this for you listening because this is a crucial distinction. We aren't just looking for a company that will simply exist in 100 years, right?
Yeah.
I mean, a brand can survive as a zombie for decades. We are looking for a company that will still have an internal engine capable of putting its money to work.
That represents the vital difference between enterprise survival and internal compounding duration.
Yeah.
A business can survive for a century just by paying out its cash as distributions. It remains long-lived, sure, but structurally, its compounding duration is completely over. It is no longer an engine, it is just a toll booth.
A toll booth, wow.
True internal compounding requires that a century from now, the business can still take the cash it generates and reinvest it productively inside its own walls. Survival and compounding are two entirely different measures of success.
So what does this all mean for us if we bring this deep dive full circle? The core thesis from The Infinite Investor is that compounding is an arbitrage, not an optimization puzzle. A business does not get to choose freely among return, quantity, and duration.
No, it doesn't.
The physical nature of the business dictates where it stands. When you evaluate a company, you aren't evaluating a theoretical ideal. You are evaluating its specific structural arbitrage exactly as it stands.
You're buying the friction. You are deciding if the structural compromises a management team has made between rate, size, and time are the right compromises for the specific wave they are attempting to ride.
And that leaves us with a final provocative thought for you to mull over. Look at the dominant companies you interact with every single day. Look past their current profit margins and ask yourself, which of these companies are actively building colossal new heavy bases to absorb their cash flow for the next decade? And which ones have silently lost their wave and are now just quietly surviving by handing all their cash back to the owners? The answer tells you everything about their true duration.
It really separates the true compounders from the mere survivors.
This content is educational and reflects a personal analytical framework. It does not constitute investment advice. Visit averagingup.com.